If you would analyze the meaning of the word man, the greatest example I could give, one of the greatest examples I could give would be Rick. He's a man, and he's all man, every bit of it.
All of us were sore at him at one time or another. Rickenbacker used that method of getting us mad enough at him that we were going to live despite him.
Rick would withhold his fire until he could frankly see the whites of the fellow's eyes, and he never missed.
From my point of view, he could properly be considered the dean of the air transport industry.
Captain Eddie, the Iron Eagle. The sound story of one of America's great heroes, Eddie Rickenbacker. Told by the people who have known him best. Captain Eddie Rickenbacker, a man of action, a man of many qualities and many sides, who stands today as a captain of industry, and who in the past has received America's highest award, the Congressional Medal of Honor. Captain Eddie is a man who has been near death many times, a man who fought against all odds to retain life. He is a man who has fought this country's battles and won, an ace of aces in the First World War, and later, a stubborn visionary who had enough faith in the air age to build one of the country's major air services. This is Eddie Rickenbacker, a tough, wiry fighter, loved by some, feared by others, but respected by all. A tough man who believes in perseverance and hard work. His good friend Arthur Godfrey puts it this way.
If you would analyze the meaning of the word man, the greatest example I could give, one of the greatest examples I could give would be Rick. He's a man, and he's all man, every bit of it. He's a man like Kurt LeMay's a man, like J. Edgar Hoover's a man. They're human, they're warm, they're big-hearted. Rick is full of the love of his country. He's unafraid to die for his country. He's the old school, you know. He has no time whatever for this sloppy business of missing education and not working. You know, every time I see him, I saw him here about a month ago, and I said, "Doggone it, Rick, you look better now than you did 5 years ago. What are you doing?" He says, "Working." Work, work, work is what does it, see?
Eddie started this work at an early age. In fact, he was only 12 years old back in 1901. When he took his first job at $3.50 a week in a glass factory in Columbus, Ohio. His father, William, had just died, leaving his mother, Elizabeth, and seven other children. Eddie was well able to take care of himself. He'd smoked cigarettes by the time he was in the first grade, and he got into so many fights that he seemed to be trying to cultivate two permanent black eyes. But when the time came, he felt his responsibility and rose to it. In the next 3 years, he tried his hand at a variety of jobs. He was a foundry worker, a monument polisher, and a railroad roustabout. But then came 1905, and young Eddie found his great love, the internal combustion engine. Soon, Eddie became a crack mechanic, but this wasn't enough. He wanted to get behind the wheel, and it wasn't long before he achieved this goal.
Well, I think my first contact with Ed was at Sioux City, Iowa in 1913.
Tommy Milton drove against Eddie many times after that as they pursued their hard and dangerous life across the continent.
Some promoters had scraped up a prairie and made a track out of it, and Ed was there with what was the predecessor of the Duesenberg car. It was a three-day meet, but the feature event was, I think 150, maybe 200 miles, which Rick won in a very spectacular drive. I recall a race at Columbus, Ohio, which incidentally I believe was Rick's hometown. and I think Rick was driving one of the Maxwell cars, which had been built by Ray Haroon, and he was leading the race. But the thing got away from him. He went through the outer fence. As I recall, Rick was not at all seriously injured in the mishap, however. Rick was much inclined to go out in front, and as long as his car stayed under him, he stayed out in front. That isn't necessarily the best way to win races. It's a lot of fun, though.
Rickenbacker became a headliner, but he never came in better than 10th in the 500-mile race at Indianapolis. But he did set a new world speed record with the Blitzen Benz at Daytona Beach. But war threatened to step into this racing career, and Eddie had an idea. He wanted to organize the country's top racing drivers into a special flying unit that would be prepared to go overseas if the United States entered the war then raging in Europe. The government turned down his suggestion, but this didn't stop Eddie. He wanted to fly, and he would make it, one way or another. He started from the ground up.
Over there, over there, send the word, over there.
7 weeks after the U.S. declared war, Eddie was sworn in as a sergeant and went overseas as a driver attached to General Pershing's staff. And later he was assigned to drive Billy Mitchell around France. Eddie pestered the famous airman for a chance to fly, and the badgering finally paid off, even though he had to lie about his age. He was almost 27, 2 years over the limit for pilots, but he made it. On completion of his flying school, he was transferred to Issoudun Field as engineering officer.
We had not been in Issoudun but a few days, and under these very bad conditions, when we found that everyone in command had a German name.
Reed Chambers, another immortal of the 94th Pursuit Squadron, tells what it was like at group headquarters.
Carl Spatz, at that time he spelled it S-P-A-A-T-Z. Of course, we later found out that he was a Pennsylvania Dutchman. And as you all know, he became one of our great generals in World War II. Was officer in charge of flying. Hermann Spiegel was officer in charge of transportation. Captain Wiedenbach was adjutant, and Tittle was sergeant major. Wiedenbach and Tittle had both served in the German army, although they were naturalized American citizens, and spoke with a very decided German accent. In view of the fact that we were being treated as enlisted men, and there were no airplanes to fly, no flying fields to fly them off of, we were, of course, very low in morale. And it wasn't too long until we made up our minds that the officers in charge of Issoudun were a bunch of dirty German saboteurs. Found that a guy in charge of engineering was named Rickenbacker. When he arrived, none of the gang would even speak to him. But I went up and said hello, and we immediately started teaming up. With that, my own crowd ostracized me. So that none of the people that I had learned to fly with in the United States would talk to Rickenbacker, and they wouldn't talk to me because I would talk to Rickenbacker.
Those were rough days for Eddie. First he was grounded, and then ostracized by his fellow flyers. But the time finally came when he was to take his first patrol over enemy territory with Douglas Campbell, another green airman.
About the end of March 1918, when our squadron had just been formed and equipped and was at a place called Villeneuve near Epernay in the Champagne district of France, Major Raoul Lufbery, who had made a great name for himself as an ace in the Lafayette Escadrille and had been and had transferred to the United States Air Service and was one of the flight commanders of our squadron, asked Rick and myself to accompany him on a patrol over the lines near Reims. We were, of course, delighted and excited because it was our first try at it. So we took off in our Newport 28s, and he led us over the lines up and down for perhaps an hour and a half, an hour and three quarters, which was the extent of our fuel supply in those aircraft. But it seemed most of the time a little dull. We encountered some anti-aircraft fire shortly after we got near the lines, which was a surprise, but one which we learned to get used to. But aside from that, it was a cold gray day with a high ceiling, and there didn't seem to be any particular activity going on, either on the ground or in the air. But when we came back to and landed at our airdrome, Luftberry asked us to report what we'd seen. So we reported the anti-aircraft bursts that had been near us, and that was all. Luftberry laughed and said, "Well, I thought you fellows probably wouldn't see much your first flight over. As a matter of fact, a flight of French Spads passed fairly close underneath us. There was another flight of French Spads off to the side at one time. And just before we started back to our landing field, there were three or four German Albatross and a German observation plane just on the other side of the lines, not very far away from us. But I knew that green pilots don't see much the first time up, so I was reluctant to attack them and get you fellas into trouble."
That's the way it went on that first flight, but it was just a start for Eddie. About a month later, on April 29th, 1918, he shot down his first German plane, an Albatross single-seater. He did this by driving his Newport out of the sun until he was less than 150 yards from his quarry before opening fire. This is the way he fought. But there were other airmen with Eddie, airmen such as Leroy Prinz, now dance director at Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer, who had fun and made merry even while flying.
I had 18 official planes to my credit. All American, of course. In fact, I was probably the only man in the 94th Squadron that had such a credit. And my title was Crash Ace. Of course, people ask me why, and I always tell them, well, we couldn't all be heroes in the 94th. Rickenbacker was setting such a terrific pace. The Germans had to shoot somebody down, and so I was elected. Unfortunately, being short, I wasn't too good a pilot. And I got called on the carpet by Rickenbacker, and he said he thought maybe it would be good for me to be assigned to General Mitchell as an aide-de-camp, which later turned out to be decorations officer. And I asked him what would be this particular reason. He said he thought it would be good for two reasons. He thought I'd be a good man, the general staff and show him out. And also, then his face got a little red and he blared up. He said he wanted to build up the Air Force a little bit. Seemed like I was taking them down faster than the Germans were. In fact, he said I was the only German ace in the American Air Force. Well, my official job was to get in a truck and come back with a load of nurses. I seemed to be able to manage and round them up all the time, and down in this gullies we'd go where a table would be set up, and we'd manage to have music and a dance, etc. And, of course, invariably, they were broken up because pretty near every night we had a visit from the Germans. I know how tough it was to have the lights go out with nothing but a lot of nurses around. That was murder.
With Eddie, it was a serious business. He hunted with coldness and logic. Not a fancy pilot, but a fighter. On the ground, he checked his engine himself, and for fear of jamming his guns in combat, he examined every bullet himself before he loaded his machine gun belt. Colonel Fred Ordway, now of Washington, describes Eddie's approach to his job.
Eddie Rickenbacker, as I've always said, was much older and more matured. He was a disciplinarian, an excellent fighter, very careful and calculating. He did not believe in taking unnecessary chances. He was quite the opposite of Frank Luke, who would not hesitate to dive into a formation of enemy aircraft when he was outnumbered 5 or 6 or 7 to 1. That didn't worry Frank Luke in the least. Eddie Rickenbacker was much more careful and calculating, and didn't believe in taking unnecessary risks. He was very strict in regard to the manner in which the pilots conducted themselves and around the airfield and, of course, in combat. And he was also very careful in protecting younger pilots on their first trips over the lines. He was would be inclined to fly above them, and if they were attacked and in a dangerous position, he would dive in on the enemy aircraft and either shoot it down or chase it away.
This has been Eddie's way of doing things throughout his life.
Rick, of course, is a hard taskmaster because he doesn't drive anybody, he leads them, but he sets a terrific example. Real leaders are that way. They set the example, lead the way, and show the way, and you just naturally fall in behind them. And he has nothing but contempt for anybody who's lazy.
Yes, Eddie was a hard taskmaster in those days, but he was no longer ostracized by his fellow pilots who had begun to love him, even though they had described him as a tough hombre. He was now a flamboyant figure in his breeches and fancy non-regulation British boots, probably the shiniest in the American Expeditionary Force. And on September 24th, 1918, he was commissioned a captain and put in command of the squadron. Eddie started out rather dramatically in his new post. Before breakfast on his first day of command, he attacked 7 German planes single-handedly and shot down 2. This feat later won for him the Congressional Medal of Honor. The 94th Squadron at this time was caught in the final big effort of the war. There were no leads and virtually no rest for the pilots. Reed Chambers, who flew with Eddie throughout this period, knows from first-hand knowledge just how Rickenbacker achieved such success.
Rick and I got permission to fly voluntary patrols together. And after our regular formations, we would take off and go out on hunting expeditions. Remember that the planes we're flying then had a top speed, even downhill, of about 130 miles an hour. He had had lots of racing experience around 100 miles an hour during hubcap to hubcap. I could out-fly Rick. I'd get on his tail and stay there. I could shoot more holes in a towed target than he could. But when the target started shooting back at me, that was a horse of a different color. Rick, I would start shooting at an enemy plane too far away, and as a result, missed many shots. Rick would withhold his fire until he could practically see the whites of the fellow's eyes, and he never missed. He was a terrific judge of distance. He only made one mistake, and one day he did pull up a little too close and clipped a German albatross with his tail skid and pulled the German's wing off. He got him by actually colliding with him without getting hurt himself. Rick and I, when we were going out alone, would always have a little private briefing and decide where we were going to go hunting and what clouds we were going to look over and under. And we developed a favorite expression, which we used always as we would part to get into our respective airplanes. And that was, "Well, baby, I'll be slapping you in the face with a spade." And it sort of became funny to us, because sometimes we weren't sure which was going to slap who in the face with a spade.
On October 30th, 1918, just before sundown, Eddie landed his plane after shooting down a Fokker and a balloon. Those were his last victories in the war. And when the armistice was signed on November 11th, the score was official. 26 planes shot down in 7 months. The end of the war for that colorful figure in his tight breeches, a man who had kept 2 SPAD pursuit planes, each bearing the number 1 in the famed Hat in the Ring insignia, who had landed one, gulped coffee, and took off in another, flying as much as 7 hours a day. But the war was over. No longer would Eddie and his fellow pilots make up such squadron ballads as this one. When the final taps have sounded, and we lay aside life's cares, and we fly our last old SPAD on heaven's golden stairs, and the angels bid us welcome, and the harps begin to play, 'tis then we'll hear St. Peter as he greets us with a yell, "Front seats for you of 94, for you've done your hitch in hell."